Episode 4 of Ricky Richards represents.
I'm brand agnostic, so I believe that a brand should earn your loyalty, not the other way around.
Hello everyone and welcome to Ricky Richards Represents, the show where we talk to leading figures of creativity and innovation. Today I'm talking to Tim Jarvis, the designer and CEO of Fabric Creative Platform, about the challenges in attracting an audience and the positive effects of effective brand communication. Let's do it. Hello everyone, thank you for tuning in to episode 4 of Ricky Richards Represents. We are listening to this actually at Google Campus, and there's a little bit of drilling going on in the background, so apologies if you do have any sound interference. Today, my guest is Tim Jarvis, and I'd love to be able to introduce him, but from his background, he's got quite a diverse background, so I'll leave it up to him to do so. So, yeah, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure, Ricky. I'm a designer. I studied product design at university when the internet was fresh and wasn't really very established, and then immediately went into doing web design, which at the time was really, really basic stuff. So with no real formal training, I kind of moved forward into graphic design and interface design about the same sort of time, and kind of went from there. Was part of the dot-com boom for a company called Internet Business Group, and we floated on the stock exchange about the same time that Last Minute did, which was a terrible idea. And then after that, I went freelance and worked with a company called Klaber. We did things like MTV and VH1 websites and stuff like that.
I noticed that you'd done something for Kasabian.
Yeah, Kasabian's first website.
Was that the one that kind of blew up on the internet?
It did at the time, because Kasabian were new, and but that was back in the time when you could make websites which were hard to use. So the whole website was like one step after another, and it kind of got progressively more into it. The more buttons you pressed and the more things you clicked, it kind of unveiled. But that was back in a different time when you could make mistakes and make crazy stuff happen.
Yeah, that's true. Because, so, I mean, when I was looking at your background, it seems like you have this very diverse interest and skill set. Your actual design style, I think, is quite refined. I was linking it to things like Serial magazine.
Yep.
And without meaning this to be like any insult or anything, it almost looks quite feminine.
Yep.
And it's got like a fashion element to it. Like, how do you think you came up with that aesthetic in your work, and, you know, what was the driving force for that for you?
Yeah, I mean, that's come up a few times. For the last sort of 12 or so years, I ran my own agency, and a lot of the work that I did in my own agency isn't the sort of work that you enjoy doing. You know, it's like the bread and butter work. So what I would do outside of that work is I would work for my friends, and I would put stuff together for them. And a lot of those guys are based in fashion, styling, and in that kind of world. And I think that basically just kind of flavored that a little bit as it went through. So I'm quite reductionist in the way that I look at my creativity. So I kind of always try and get things down to the most minimal and tightest point. So that does mean that they do become quite stark. They do become quite androgynous. And they do work best with well-curated imagery as well.
Yeah, this is something I've noticed a lot, is that actually, especially when you're doing things like web design and you're working clients, it's the photography which separates what makes a site look good and what doesn't. Funnily enough, actually, before even looking into your work, I stumbled across the bottle design that you'd done. I believe it's still like...
For the almond milk one.
Yeah, it's in stores, right?
Yes.
I literally picked up that bottle and was like, this is beautiful.
Thanks, man.
And it was like £6 or something. I was like, forget that. but it was a beautiful piece of design nonetheless. And then just so happened, the day later, I realised you'd done it.
Yep, that's one of mine.
Yeah. So when you started your own agency, you started a branding agency, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it was actually a digital agency, but the stuff that I got the most enjoyment out of was the branding side. What we would tend to do in the early days is we would effectively be a full service for entrepreneurs. So a guy comes along with an idea of, I want to create this kind of digital presence. And normally the first part of that was to create a brand and to create a corporate identity for them. And then, you know, start working on the website and start working on the print collateral for that from then.
So before I go any further, if you're starting an agency and you're looking to kind of, I guess when you start any business venture, one of your main incentives is to make money.
Yeah.
That people tend to go for well-established clients due to the fact they've got budgets and systems in place already that you can kind of tap into.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurs, unless they've got funding, typically don't have money.
True.
Were you going after people that were funded, or was it a case of it was the social good?
it was more the social good and the belief that what they were doing would be worth the effort in time. And it is always the case when you've started a new agency and you're looking for clients, you obviously take the ones that come along, and the work that you put out with does end up bringing you more clients along. But if I'm honest, most of those clients didn't pay very much money, and a lot of them were quite hard to get money out of as well.
Because, I mean, being in the tech industry yourself, you are fully aware of the fact that most startups fail.
Yeah, absolutely.
So
yeah.
What was the thing, like, how did you determine a client that was worth spending time with and ones that weren't?
We were giving a lot of ourselves to those projects. So if I liked the project and I like where it's going, and more importantly, I guess, if I could get on with whatever entrepreneur, then you generally start a longer relationship going over time. So money was never a priority for me personally. My business partner was more money orientated, certainly. And that helped because that gave me a bit more free rein to work on my stuff. In fact, when I first started Provision, there were three directors. I was one of them. We had a financial director who ended up getting us blacklisted from MTV. One of the first jobs I brought to the table was an MTV job for Xbox's launch. And he blacklisted us because he was so pushy about getting paid. And a company like MTV, they take so long to pay you. That sort of thing happens.
Yeah.
So that does happen.
Cash flow is a massive deal with agencies.
Yeah, and especially, yeah, totally. And, you know, making sure that you can always pay everyone. That's the thing that I struggled with the longest over that sort of 10-year period, is actually making sure that your employees get paid and then you've got something at least to live off afterwards.
You know, the creative industry in general just isn't it's a 5% game. The people that are at the top are kind of making money, and the people further down the chain, not so much. And it's a kind of about establishing yourself, which I guess segues quite heavily into the branding, comes into what you're doing now. Yep. What is it about branding specifically? And what do you think separates a good brand from a bad brand?
So for me, branding's about evolution. You don't just spend a month on something and then it's done. For me, that brand starts somewhere, and where it ends up is normally quite a different place. You can see the journey that takes. And that's kind of the enjoyment I get out of it, as well as working through kind of initial briefs and stuff like that with clients, and also educating those guys about where the brand should be, where its market should be and stuff. And then over 6 months or a year or 2 years or however long you guys are working together, you go from this kind of idea that you all had into actually where it lives in the world. And those two things can be quite different. And for me, that's where I get the enjoyment. It's like it's actually like your baby. And I think branding has the most kind of feel to that out of any of the creative disciplines.
This is a discussion I've had with friends of mine when I've talked about whether I'd like to create a brand or redesign an existing one, or even... I think there's something with branding to be said about just exposure levels. Mm-hmm. There's plenty of brands, and I'm not talking about the values, just aesthetics, the front-facing stuff that people recognise, where there's plenty of brands that have terrible logos that are well-known.
Yeah, totally. And sometimes it's not even the logo that counts. You know, if a brand, for me, when I explain what branding is, I always say that branding is basically the gap between you and where your customer is. So it's filling up that gap. Well, that can be voice, it can be graphical, it can be any number of things. It could be feelings, you know, it could be TV adverts, it could be whatever it can be. But it's an evolutionary thing. And that changes as you kind of get an idea of what you're trying to achieve with your company as well.
Another little point on that, I mean, not to make this about my opinions on branding, but I always tell people that the first sign of a person's brand is the clothes they wear. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sat here right now in shorts and t-shirt because it's boiling in London. But you can often tell when a student walks into the room versus a seasoned professional. Obviously, they've got a bit more money to spend on clothing, but you can create a facade, an image that you're trying to sell to a customer based on the clothes you wear. And then your values and the way you communicate and everything else pushes out from that. Talking about personal branding as opposed to corporate branding, a logo's... In this the typical sense, are they still valid, or do you think that less so?
Do you know what? I do think less so now. I think that that maybe maintaining a kind of a style, whether that's typographically or colour and tone, is probably more important than what we used to have in the old days, which was everybody had their own personal logo. And I think your name is now more than that. So, yeah, I think that's definitely changed.
Just, this is just pure curiosity. When I was looking at your site yesterday, you've got what looks to me like an eagle-less or like a bird shape, kind of. Yeah. What's the story behind that?
I actually have that tattooed on my back as well.
Right. We've got to get a snap of that, by the way.
Although it's kind of going to be faded and funny now. It's an image that I once saw, sort of something similar in like a copy of NME when I was like 17 or 18 or something like that. And I liked this image. It was like a crane, like a Japanese crane. And it has been, like, people said it's similar to the Lufthansa logo, and it is. And it comes from the same roots, I guess, as well. And I like that image, and it always stuck with me when I used to do personal artwork as a kid, basically. I would use it. And when graphics and computers and stuff became a lot more fun, I would play with it, and then I would incorporate it and stuff like that. And it stuck with me because I haven't found a better reason to get rid of it.
Yeah.
And because it's on my back.
Yeah, so that's a good reason. But that, I think that's, there's something to be said for that, in the consistency and longevity. Like, I've had my logo since first year of uni, so it's probably 7-8 years now. Yeah. I've never changed it. And the reason, a lot of people, when they look to refresh, sometimes change. But I think this is why designers push so heavily on the kind of fundamental design principles, is that it's got longevity. It will last theoretically forever.
Yeah, just don't put it on your back. So that crane is kind of for my Magnosoma work, which is really kind of the personal artwork side of what I do. So it's only really something that I use for the very personal stuff. You know, the things that I do outside of any kind of work or client environment or anything like that.
As well as your design work, you're obviously working with fabric.
Mm-hmm.
How do you juggle that balance?
So that balance is juggled by being 100% fabric at the moment, which means that I just have to commit to not doing any real personal work outside of that. There's basically no time or strength left in me to do that. So to put a bit of background on that, a couple of years ago, Phil, who used to work with me and myself at Proficient, we wanted to start creating a little platform that we could give to our friends to put their portfolio work online. And we wanted it to be quite a kind of a long format, really case study based stuff, kind of a magazine style thing. Like, if you guys have ever seen what VS Co do with their kind of journal things, it's kind of a case study of each person's work. So we started down this route, and we had a project called Dogma, which we had kind of built from scratch. But it was such a hard piece of tech for two people to build outside of doing our own client work, that we kind of put foresights on it, and then we realized we were just basically going to kill each other before we finished this thing. I mean, the commitment is so strong. And at the same time that we were doing that, some friends of Phil's were working on fabric, and they were starting to move in some slightly different directions. They're commercials directors, and they were getting quite good at making commercials, so they were doing that more.
Let's just name drop them, because, I mean, they're certainly a notable mention.
They are. So that's Chris and Luke, who are together commercial music producers, commercial directors called Us, and they have done some work for companies like Airbnb and Xfinity in the States, and also they've done some music videos for like Wiley
Bass Academy, right?
Yeah,
hopefully I can get them on.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they're good boys.
Yeah.
So those guys were stepping away, which left a creative vacuum for fabric going forwards. So we decided to pool our resources, put everything together, and sort of take it from there, really.
So the question that everyone wants to know, your title is officially CEO, is that correct?
Yep.
How does a designer become CEO of a tech company? Is it the fact that you, I guess, were one of the founding team, or?
Yeah, but also because, I mean, I think that a CEO at this level is really only a title. So I could be a CEO one day and a creative director the next day and do exactly the same job. So yeah, I mean, as a CEO, my role is supposed to be in trying to find a future for us. You know, that's kind of important, and you know, that's what I spend my time doing.
My question around that is, as a design-orientated person, you're aesthetically driven. there's a lot of things that you can do to refine a product, make it look beautiful. And when you're in the tech industry, it's often about, you know, getting retention, getting acquiring new customers. How do you find breaking your attention from, you know, effectively what was your passion and now having to do more business orientated tasks?
Yeah. Running a business wasn't something I was new to. I eventually, with Provision, I kind of split with my business partner and I ran it entirely. So I was used to doing the financials, used to doing that kind of stuff, and basically just overseeing it. So it was kind of comfortable for me to do that for a tech company. As a creative, there is a divide between developers and creatives in how they work, and there is a little middle ground in there, but it's quite hard to maintain. It's good because there is a conflict there, and when you can both sort of work against each other, but kind of compassionately and responsibly with each other, you get the best result out of it. So, you know, I was a creative with two developers, two engineers, and I think that we got the best result out of it by arguing absolutely all the time. You know, the strength of arguing until you finally find the happy medium in that.
Was there ever any days when those arguments became days where you weren't talking, or were you always able to recover?
There were some. I was in LA last year, working out there, and I woke up one morning and looked at the website and it had changed, the homepage had changed. And this freaked me out, like totally freaked me out, because it's kind of like, as a creative, you have your domains and there are certain things I would never touch. But the boys had set up an A-B test over here, and obviously they've been doing this one night and they hadn't told me, so I wasn't seeing everything that everyone was seeing, but I was like, how, what have you guys done? You know, it looks like every single other website in the world, and I don't want it to be like that. But there, you know, we're A-B testing it to make sure that people can understand it. And I'm like, yeah, I kind of get that. It's fair enough. If it makes a better product, if it makes something work, then okay, you know, I'll totally have that. It didn't, and we went back.
Okay, so this is a topic that has affected me as well. So again, when you're a designer, you've got this quite clear aesthetic understanding. But then when you listen to marketing and you look at marketing blogs, it says, put a whopping great yellow button, put a pop-up that comes over your website in order to capture more email. Instantly, your page starts turning into this like spam site.
Yeah.
But I mean, I listened to a fact today that said that 40% of people don't realize that the results at the top of Google ads.
Yeah.
And so while we're digitally native and savvy to these things, there's the reason people say encourage that is because there's an overwhelming number of people that don't get that that's what people are doing.
Yeah.
How do you fight that battle? Because Fabric's a beautiful platform.
Well, this is actually a really easy battle to fight, because you obviously have to create something that your audience want to use. Okay. So it just so happens that our audience are creatives, and they're creatives generally, you know, they're employed and they're generally doing work at the top of their game, which means that they're used to using products like Apple, like Leica and stuff like that. So they have an idea of what a website should look like, and they have an idea of how it should work, and it isn't to have massive yellow buttons and stuff all over the place.
So there's an argument there though that, so that's what they want. Is it what they need? You know, like a designer, there's so many struggling creatives that could probably benefit from capturing an email list or establishing more of an audience.
Yeah.
I'm not, you know, I think Fabric's beautiful and I use other platforms for other reasons. I host my portfolio on Fabric because it is that beautiful window.
Yeah, I know you've got a persona as well.
So, yeah.
As do I, actually, as well.
And I mean, yeah, so I don't really need you to answer anything there, but it's just sometimes, are we going after what they want or what people need? Is it?
Yeah, I mean, from my own opinion, which I guess is subject to my route as well, desirability has a whole lot to do with getting the required effect that you want out of something. And if we're trying to sell a product, desirability is really important for us. If you're trying to get as many users to do X, Y, and Z as possible, then obviously the closest and quickest route to that is the right one. But for us, it's definitely desirability.
Let's talk about the actual platform itself. Like, what's the vision? You've touched on it briefly, but how are you building this?
So the vision for Fabric is to make it as fast and as simple as possible for a creative individual to get their portfolio of work. So, I mean, we've still got some work to do on achieving everything we want out of this. but we've made a start. We try to get rid of the blank page. So the hardest thing for you to do as a creative starting your own portfolio is to start with a white page and go, how the, am I going to fill this? Okay. So we try to bring content in from places where you already might have it. Things like Vimeo, YouTube, Flickr and stuff like that, where you might already have content.
Flickr?
Yeah.
Still
yeah.
going?
It's still going. Yeah, and that may not be the best.
You've got some others on your site as well. I've noticed. I was having a little dig around the other day. It, probably more places where designers lie, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that we don't have is a linking with Behance at the moment because they don't give people access to their API. But we will try and, or we aim to suck in content from wherever we can. Basically, the bottom line is that if you've already put your content up on these services that you use, then you're happy with your content and you've made some decisions about it already. So it makes it easier for you to then put that stuff.
So basically what you want to do is cream Behance where people have already created their portfolio and present it better on your platform.
Yeah, I mean, they have a competing product.
They
which
do,
doesn't
which,
help.
Which I don't mind saying isn't great.
No.
It's basically, if you've got no idea, you end up either with a Wix website or a Behance pro site.
Yeah.
So do you mind me mentioning the nemesis?
No.
Like I rate Squarespace. Mm-hmm. I rate it for different reasons. I like some of the behind the scenes functionality that I don't think many creatives would necessarily use unless they've got a skew towards marketing and business and stuff. But what's the differentiator between Squarespace?
So I think Squarespace is a good product for what it does, especially since they've moved towards e-commerce. Squarespace is an excellent product for a company that's had as much money and as many people working in it as it has. But where it differentiates from Fabric is that Fabric is designed around projects and portfolios, whereas Squarespace is designed around pages. And with a page, you can put anything in a page. It can be a product page for a shop. It could be a contact form. It could be anything you like. But with Fabric, because we know the content that you're going to add to a project, we can make a lot more assumptions about how to display that. What that means is that with Fabric, you can add images, you can add text, and you can add videos. So if we know there's going to be video in there, we can display that video in a very specific way. And what that allows Fabric to do is to have layouts for each of the themes. And that means that, say, you've got a theme like you'd have a WordPress theme or a Squarespace theme. It has a specific style and look. But within that, you have layouts as well. And layouts can change the way that that content looks within that theme. So you can have a layout that focuses your video at the top, or you can have a layout which is all about light boxes. And this is not, you know, there are other projects that do this as well. But, you know, that's the kind of the identifier that makes it that much different, that you can go, right, I can press a single button and change the layout very quickly. So that means that with something like Fabric, you can go from nothing to an entire website in about 10 minutes. Suck stuff in, press a few buttons, and boom.
Yeah, and this isn't just me plugging Fabric, but I spend probably disproportionate amounts of time looking at these platforms, and I don't have particular... Like, I have some loyalty with mm-hmm. Fabric because when I communicated with you, we met quite quickly, and I believe your community is quite high level.
Yeah.
Which we'll go into next, I guess. But if you're looking to get a portfolio online, it's definitely one which is worth looking into. I'll stop plugging you, and let's talk about the community.
Sure.
Before I get into the nitty gritty around how you're making money through the community, I guess, but like, how are you building this community?
So Fabric started really through Chris and Luke's exposure. So it is primarily filmmakers at the moment, backed up by photographers and graphic designers, illustrators and that kind of stuff, but primarily filmmakers. And we have sort of keyed development to be kind of quite like that. You know, it's very much about large expanses of imagery with text over the top, and it has a relatively cinematic feel for a portfolio builder. All of our subscribers are through word of mouth. We've done more or less no advertising. We're not backed by investors or anything like that. We built the entire thing basically off our own backs. So the only money that we take out of Fabric is really, you know, what people give us in subscriptions. And it's, you know, it's enough to keep us alive for now.
So typically, subscription model business would look to identify a cheap keyword in Google that shows a level of intention.
Yeah.
How much is your subscription?
It's £6.90 a month or £69 a year.
So cheap.
Yeah, it's cheaper than Squarespace.
Yeah, quite considerably actually. But what's the retention like?
We look at retention in terms of churn, which is how many people have left the platform. And I, without turning my laptop on, I can't tell you exactly what it is, but it's less than 2%. Fabric's been going on and off in beta or live for about 4 years. In that 4 years, we've lost about 100 people that have ever subscribed.
So, 100, you've lost 100 times 100,000. So, about 500 users.
So, no, we've lost 100 per, like, that's it.
5,000.
Yeah, so we have about 1,000.
Right.
And altogether, we've had about, you know, like, basically about
100. So, you've lost 10 plus,
Yeah.
So, my question is, once you've got someone on the platform, the lifetime value of a customer is pretty good.
Yeah, it's about 4 years.
Which
is about how long it's been going. So hopefully it'll be longer than 4 years when we've been going for longer.
So with 4 years of assuming that, say, let's call it three for the sake of it, it's £65, you say?
69,
70, so 210 over the lifetime of a customer, assuming 3 years.
Yeah.
For £210, you should be able, like, I'm sure you could acquire a customer for 50.
There is a rule of thumb that says that, you should do it about a quarter. Your cost for acquisition of a customer is about a quarter of their lifetime value.
Right.
So, that's actually about right. We look at our lifetime value as being nearer £280 based on our own kind of assumptions and stuff that we have. So we have a maximum of about 70.
And so are you growing it by word of mouth now purely because of the size of the team?
Yes.
Is this something that if you were to get investment, you'd probably start pumping those channels?
Yeah, totally. If we were to gain an investment, this is exactly what Squarespace do. And any company like that, all investment basically goes on marketing, pretty much. So marketing basically being your way of saying to the world that you exist. And that's kind of the most important thing for any subscription-based model like ours. So currently it's word of mouth. People that use it out there in the world, when their friends say, I really could do it with a portfolio, these guys will say, actually, you should try these guys and see if it works. But obviously, marketing is really where all that cash goes.
You were talking earlier about assumptions around creatives. So you're saying you can make certain assumptions so you know the kind of things that your customers want on the platform.
Yeah.
What are some of maybe the surprising assumptions? Like, I've got a belief that maybe creatives don't update their work. I think this is something we may have talked about in the past, as much as you'd expect.
It's true. And I've had this with I've had portfolios for almost 15 years in one shape or another. And what tends to happen is that you create a portfolio and then that's pretty much the end of it. And it's obviously in our best interests to make sure that it's as easy as possible to do that so that you want to update it. So Fabric has a blog, and the idea behind that is to use it more often. You know, if you're looking for a job or you just basically want to get some more kudos for what you're doing and you want to have your face in the world, then that's why you have a portfolio. Especially if you're looking for a job, if you find a job, then it tends to go a bit.
Are there any other insights that you've discovered about creatives in general?
No, this is a good question. It's interesting to see how different creatives look at their portfolio in different ways. So, and also how they look at trying to use a product like Fabric as well. And it does totally depend on where they've come from before. Like if they've come from Cargo or Squarespace, they have different ideas and maybe kind of demands on what a portfolio platform can do. So there's no specific thing in there, but you can see basically where someone's come from based on what they're trying.
I bet, so Squarespace, users are asking for more functionality.
Well, Squarespace users always ask, like, how do I set up pages? Like, totally, right. Always. And it's like, so we have to kind of get people into the idea that it's projects. Like, put projects together, and then you can change your themes, you can change your styles, you can change your colours, but put some work in there first.
Because this is just an idea that I'm starting to float when I'm talking with people now. And this isn't something that Fabric can actually do, but I think it's worthwhile in the world we live in. Is kind of setting up these, like when you deliver a pitch, it used to be a board, you know, whereas now I believe you can create an effective web template, send it, have video embeds, links through to data and stuff. It just makes the whole experience a little bit more interactive.
Yeah, treatments.
Yeah, effectively. But stuff like that is probably fabric deals more with the front-facing portfolio? No,
I mean, we did actually, like, this shows how often you go there as well. We did actually do an update about 2 or 3 months ago for private projects.
Right.
So you can set up private projects and private portfolios.
Yeah.
Which means that you can put a portfolio of projects and or just projects together and send them to clients without them being front-facing on your website.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, we did that specifically because filmmakers certainly often use their websites for treatments.
What does fabric mean?
Fabric means factory in a lot of languages like German, and I think some Northern European ones as well. So I didn't choose the name. That already existed before we got involved.
Factory. Let's churn them out.
Factory, yeah. And it's anything but.
Okay. Well, I believe we've delved deep into the portfolio sphere.
Mm-hmm.
Plenty of insights there for people to be getting on with. So let's get to some of the questions I just have in general. Hopefully you can pull some nice insights out for everyone.
Sure.
So who were your biggest influences growing up and what did you learn from those people?
So growing up, my two biggest influences were Vaughan Oliver and Peter Saville. I didn't really know them as individuals at the time, and I just used to love album covers. So Vaughan Oliver is responsible for a lot of 4AD's covers, so things like Pixies and stuff like that from the late 80s and early 90s. So I would have these covers and I would love to look at them. And obviously everybody knows what Peter Saville's done. And it only became later in my career, as I actually became a graphic designer, that I could see that these guys, all these things were connected. All these album covers were connected. And I loved the music, so it made sense. So that's definitely flavoured where I came from. Peter Saville's graphic style certainly has had a lot of sort of influence on where I've come from.
What was it specifically, like, so you say it was just the connections between their work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I used to listen to this music all the time. The album covers are obviously important about that. And then you kind of like, that's, I guess, sort of influenced me to do what I do anyway.
For example, say George Lois was quite an inspiration of mine, and that translated to quite bold visuals, simple.
Yeah.
What was it like? How did it translate for you?
Vaughan Oliver is, he often works with type over imagery, and the imagery tends to be dark and the type tends to be light. He often uses italics and all caps serifs together. So I think I kind of liked that aesthetic. Those typographical things are often put in boxes and they've got lines and stuff on them as well. Then on the other side, you have Peter Saville, who kind of creates very structural, minimal creative work, graphic work. And I find a balance in what he does. It kind of makes sense to me. Like, I look at something that he's done and I feel comfortable with it, very comfortable with it. And I think that's something that I've emulated in my own work. His balance of colour and using flat content and flat colour areas in imagery with photography has really been kind of quite influential to me.
Okay, so when you're actually creating work, are there any routines that you help you to create generally?
Yeah, so I reduce all the time. I'm really, really all about reducing as much as I can. So I'll start with, say, a bunch of different fonts, and I'll look at font pairing, and then I'll look at sort of trends in fonts and stuff, and then I'll reduce down to the one I like the most and the one that I can find the best pair with. And this is the same for what I do with creating themes and stuff on fabric as it is with branding. So I often start with typography first. And then that gives me something that I can then use with other assets. So oftentimes, with my background, I didn't work for major clients, so I'd have to source or create assets myself. If you're working for Nike or whomever else, you'll get assets from them. And then if you don't have those, you have to start with something. So
it's unusual to start with type.
Yeah, well, I often didn't have assets to start with.
Because that's typically, it gets left to the end quite often, right?
Yeah.
And so was that just a love of type that made you come start from that?
Yeah, but also just because there was literally nothing else that I could physically rely on. So if I'm running a bunch of different kind of treatments to a client, like photo treatments, the one thing that doesn't tend to change is the type.
Would you attach the type to the brand values that you'd created?
Yeah, definitely.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was the biggest struggle you faced creatively, and if you've overcome it, how did you overcome it? Or if you haven't, like, what do you intend, what are you trying to do to overcome it?
So I think both as an individual creative and running something like Fabric, we have this mentality of like build it and they will come. but it just isn't true. Like, the world is so full of noise, especially now. You know, 10 years ago, it wasn't so much, but the world is now so full of noise that you have to hammer something home in order to get it through to people. So, and it has to be constant hammering as well. You know, there's so much stuff out there that nobody has to care. Unless you create something which is like mind-blowingly amazing and it goes viral, which is often what happens with things like music videos and stuff, a lot of creativity just gets completely ignored.
I completely agree with that. In the talk I kind of gave here, which probably wasn't greatly received, but...
I think it was.
You think?
Yeah.
I appreciate that. I do believe that if you're exceptionally creative, your work will cut through. But unfortunately, most 99% of work that's created isn't exceptionally creative or come with a massive bit of leverage behind it. If you've got 20 million followers, whether your work's better than the person or not, the person with the biggest clout is gonna win out in that battle. So you've either got to do something exceptionally different that catches people's attention, or you've got to be comfortable pushing your own work.
Yes, you do. Yeah.
Which is a massive struggle for creatives, especially because it's seen in our industry as a little bit of like, I'm not sure how to describe this, but people don't like people who shout about their own stuff.
Yeah.
But it's almost essential to push yourself forward.
Yeah, I've always been really wary of where that tipping point is between really pushing your stuff down people's throats so they're sick of you and they end up blocking you, and actually just not doing it enough to get noticed. So once upon a time, 7 or 8 years ago, when things like Found and stuff were quite new, there wasn't so much noise and people could see stuff for longer. There were bigger design forums, things like News Today and stuff like that, and there wasn't so much content on them, so the content that was on them stayed there for longer, so more people saw it. But now there's so much content in the world and it moves so quickly that you only push, right? And that's the only way that you can really find anything.
The other side to this as well is that, I mean, myself personally, I'm struggling more and more every day to be passionate about the work I do when you're seeing so much exceptional work.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
you're probably seeing, you know, the one or two projects that are the best projects of everyone else's. But because there's an abundance of it, it seems like everyone is just creating exceptional work 24/7, and you have to be, you know, some form of absolute train in order to keep up with it.
Yeah, exceptional work. It's true, actually. There are so many exceptionally creative individuals out in the world now that for a newcomer, like a student or something like that, studying graphic design, I honestly feel a little bit like, where the hell do you start? You know, like, yeah,
land on the Behance homepage and you look at student work and you go, man, there is like a Grand Canyon gap between the standard of these people and where the industry's at.
Do you know, I think that if you are starting out, probably the best way to do that is to collaborate. This is actually something that works for Behance users. It's by multiple artists or multiple creators working on one piece. So if you can, what I started doing early on in my digital graphic career is collaborate with other people, because then there's two of you pushing the same thing. So I think really that's probably the best thing that you can try if you're fresh.
Yeah, it's kind of, I guess, what a lot of, especially when you're first starting out, you'll work on a project for, say, Nike, and you'll be one of 15 people working on it, but you can feature it in your portfolio.
For sure, yeah.
So that gives you a little bit of leverage to start getting the ball rolling. What is one thing that you've learned that's changed your life forever?
I think the thing that I've learned is really how to run my own business. I'm not saying that was a really smart move. I'm just saying that it's changed my life forever. So I did freelance for a while and I was stuck at home for 6 months and I didn't really enjoy that. So I kind of went into business with somebody I knew, kind of a guy that I used to work with, and it worked really well for a while anyway. And I don't regret any of that, but it turned me from a creative that sort of used to work on cool stuff into a businessman. And that was kind of a different me, but actually a really important me, especially as far as confidence is concerned. So, and the ability to talk to people outside of your immediate group set. So I think that was really important. I watched other creatives that I used to know pretty well move through the ranks of larger agencies and get really well paid and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think that they have as much fun or maybe as much passion for what they do, because they're still part of something bigger. Whereas for me, it was always just working for yourself. I would rather do that. Yeah, financially, it's probably not the most amazing thing you can do.
You say that, but I've always had this argument. I mean, I'm in an agency right now, but I don't like the service industry business model. I just feel like it's a bit of a sucker's game.
Mm-hmm.
You run an agency, you're doing work for a client. As soon as you finish that project, you're back to zero.
Yeah.
Whereas you're now in a product business, you're building a platform. It's kind of like we talk about assets, right? You're creating an asset that you can, and a portfolio is an asset.
Yeah.
You can use it to then go into another client and try and pitch them to do work based on the work you've previously done. Was that a conscious decision for you?
Yeah, definitely. I found it was time for me to, it was two things. Firstly, I wanted to work with other creatives more often. And secondly, I wanted to do something that wasn't just chucking work out into the world. I wanted to create something that other people would enjoy using. That was really important. I mean, that's funny. You sit there and you go, right, you know, I value now. What the hell am I going to do for the next 5 to 10 years? I want to create something that other people enjoy using rather than just people look at or it sells stuff. You know, that doesn't really interest me that much. So I think that with the agency model, if you're working on a campaign or with a client that you enjoy working with and you kind of get good work out of them, that's totally great and definitely stick with that. But I didn't have that opportunity where I was.
And I think at the end of the day, even when you're doing that, you've got to be realistic with yourself and say, even if we've got this great relationship, I'm selling shit.
Yeah.
It's not always shit. Sometimes it's a great product.
But it's not necessarily what you believe in.
Yeah, and it's not the clients that you're selling genuinely great products are few and far between.
Yeah.
You know, like our agency works with a breast cancer awareness charity called Copperfield,
mm-hmm.
and we don't earn tremendous amounts of money from that, if anything at all. But that's our way of saying, right, our creative contribution is providing value in the world.
Yeah.
Whereas we'll do stuff for other clients, I won't name drop, but at the end of the day, it's not necessarily doing better. You're not providing value to people, you're just expressing your creativity for the sake of selling. Everyone knows this. I don't know why I'm banging on about it. So how do you think the industry will change in 10 years?
Automation is a really important factor for creativity. I'll talk about this in a little bit with Fabric about where we're going with the product. So it means that I have to do a lot of research into automation and machine learning and artificial intelligence, machine intelligence, that kind of stuff. And it's said that the two things that you can't automate are creativity and jobs where one human being needs to basically tell another human being how to do stuff, like in a learning way, you know. But I think that with our industry, with creativity and with creating creative assets, I think that we will get to a stage where maybe in the next 10 years or so, we'll see like automated art working. So rather than me sitting there doing the grunt work, my computer or whatever it might be can help me create what I want, you know, automatically. It can typeset for me. It can create 25 pages if I give it one page. And I think that is a really nice place to sort of head to for us.
Yeah, that's when you're, I guess, like working in InDesign and you're creating a template page, and then you're replicating it, so it makes that process a lot more efficient. That's kind of, I guess, the early iteration of that theory.
Yeah, and it's especially if you design for print, sometimes it can be difficult. So especially if you're not used to it, and having some sort of a automated system that could just really do that work for you, prepping things, I think would be amazing.
Well, let's just very briefly touch on that, because we're talking about the industry in 10 years. Is print going to be about?
Oh yeah, definitely.
You think it'll just be like a legacy thing that you can't get rid of it because it's so fundamentally ingrained in the... How many people are really buying magazines now?
Well, that's a good question. I think that in like 200 years or something, maybe print won't be about, but I think in the next 10 years, things don't change that much. And also we still need, it's easier for us to consume certain types of information. Like it's more about a pace, maybe a speed of consumption for the kind of that sort of stuff. But a magazine is still a great piece of something.
Everyone always argues about the tangible nature of print, and I agree with that. There's nothing quite like picking up a nice magazine. I just feel sorry for the people that are trying to sell them.
yeah, absolutely. I mean, you picked up Serial earlier on in the chat, and obviously I know who Serial are, and I love what they do. And that's
me too. Like I was digging around for their photographers the other day because they take such beautiful.
They do. Yeah.
It's amazing.
And you can't really replicate that on an iPad yet. Maybe on a massive iPad Pro with an incredible screen, then you could. But it's the way that the paper treats the ink that has, you know, especially for Serial, something like that works. And the same for a lot of fashion publications as well.
It's quite a nice transition. So what book or learning resource has been the biggest impact on you and why?
So I've got a couple for this one. There is a book, and I just have to look down to see what it's called because it's got a long title, The Art of Human-Computer Interface Design by Brenda Laurel. It's kind of from probably the late 80s by the time it turned into a book, but Brenda Laurel was part of the Xerox PARC team that eventually moved into other places like Apple and stuff, and they're kind of responsible for what most people consider to be the graphical user interface. And a lot of the book, they talk about, from a very base term, their experiments and how they came up with certain ideas that we now take for granted and everything. They have concepts in the book like, for example, a file on your laptop kind of gets yellower with age. So it kind of starts off white and pristine, and then the longer it's been there, it kind of gets yellower and stuff like that. So the ideas that they were playing with back in the late 70s have kind of changed the way that we work now. And I read this book when I was studying product design, and I was trying to understand really about how computers worked because they were quite basic. And that stayed with me. And also, I used to read a lot of sci-fi, kind of like 10 minutes into the future sci-fi, like William Gibson and stuff like that, because he would paint such very detailed sort of 5 to 10 year time landscapes that I could really borrow from. And I did, right. as a product designer.
So you say William Gibson?
Yes, yeah.
So I really struggle with just reading narrative books in general. It's very difficult to invest the amount of time in a book and hope you get something out of it compared to non-fiction. It's quite difficult. So which book of his in particular is like that's the one that you're going to, you know, of all the books you've read of his, that is the one which...
Yeah, so they are novels. Those ones.
Yeah.
And I think that his later work, he did a lot of stuff in the 80s, which has been very much kind of turned into cyberpunk and stuff like that. But his later work is more descriptive and closer to where we are now. There's a book of his called Pattern Recognition, which I remember, I haven't read it for a long time, I remember it being like quite good stuff. And he has another book called Idoru, which is about a digital...
Idoru.
Or Idoru, right. I-D-O-R-U. It's about a kind of a virtual Japanese pop star. And there are things like from that book, which is a 90s book, that are now very much, you know, where we are now and where we're about to go.
What tools do you use to be more effective?
So what I spend most of my time working in is Adobe's Creative Suite, whether that's Photoshop, Illustrator or InDesign, depending on what I'm doing. But I use Slack a lot for... running a company, a small company like ours, Slack works somewhere in between email and Messenger. So it's effectively a consistent way of everybody being on the same page and talking and stuff. And we have a lot of hooks into Slack to see what's going on with Fabric as well, like when people subscribe and all that kind of stuff. When we get mentions on Twitter and things like that, it all kind of comes in there. So it's kind of like a text dashboard of where we are day-to-day as a company. I use Trello as well.
Big fan of Trello.
Yeah, I have a notebook and I love my notebook. And my notebook is my everything, but Trello is kind of my digital version of my notebook.
What's your favourite film documentary?
I think I've got two favourite films. The Wizard of Oz in 2001. And I think really, especially The Wizard of Oz, it's how it looks and just how vivid and wonderful it is. And I think obviously, you know, Wizard of Oz has always been here. It's so old as a film that everything growing up kind of has some reference to it, you know, as far as I was aware. You know, that probably sounds a bit silly, but you know, you can see it's a cultural thing.
Your work had
I mean younger than that, when I was a kid, when I was a tiny kid. And then things like 2001 is another one of those things that I just look at and it feels very comfortable to me. You know, the way that the ships kind of dance to the kind of like slow opera.
I've not actually seen either, so
well
I can go, this gives me something to delve into.
Yeah, well, I watched 2001 at the cinema a couple of years ago. It doesn't happen very often, but it's amazing to watch at the cinema. So we saw it at the BFI, and it is just, it's out there.
What event would you recommend to people?
We go to a few events quite regularly as Fabric. One of them is Bug, which is hosted by Adam Buxton, and that's basically about the evolution of music videos. And it's just awesome fun. He goes through, like, I think it's once every 2 months, and he goes through kind of recent music videos and kind of that culture. It's over at the BFI as well, and it's just a really good thing to watch. You know, go along, be entertained for a couple of hours and see some really inspirational stuff as well. Glug is run by a friend of mine called Nick. Those guys are really good at engaging London's creative scene. So they do quite a lot of events now, but they're just really on it, basically. Good guys, just trying to make sure that as many creators as possible get inspired.
I went to one at the House of Vans. It was really
good. Yeah, that's right. And then we have our own little portfolio power-ups that we've just started, which is where we can get a bunch of people together and talk about their portfolios and talk about their work and try and give them something out of that. Ricky was was one of our leaders last time.
Early adopter.
Yeah, exactly. It was a good fun night. We hope to do another one in October.
Yeah.
So, yeah. I mean, I'd love to get more of those done.
So these are the quick fire questions. We're approaching an hour now, so we'll power through them.
Mm-hmm.
What's your favourite brand and why?
I'm brand agnostic, Ricky. So I, as a brand person myself, I believe that a brand should earn your loyalty, not the other way around. And because I believe that brands change, I think that goes through phases as well. So I don't have a favourite brand. Sorry.
It's all right. That's a very interesting answer. What do you do for fun outside of work?
So I guess the normal things that people in London do for fun, which is basically hang around in parks, get drunk and do stuff like that. But also I've done Muay Thai for about maybe 7 or 8 years, which I find is like a really nice way to discipline myself and kind of just get something that's a bit activity based. I really enjoy it.
That's amazing. So I did not expect that.
I love kicking stuff.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely love kicking
stuff. When you delve into a martial art, I mean, I've been very tempted to do it myself because I'm a regular gym goer, but I want that mental discipline.
Yeah.
I like people to push me. But do you, are the trainers encouraging you to fight?
It depends. Like, I'm not very good at normal gym stuff. Like, that whole kind of thing about going from sort of machine to machine and knowing how they work and actually being disciplined enough to use them isn't something that I have. So I've always done martial arts. I started with capoeira, moved into kickboxing, and now Muay Thai. And it depends on the gym you're at, whether you're expected to effectively turn it into something real. So there are casual gyms and there are fighters' gyms, and I've done both. I'm too old to be a fighter.
How old are you?
41.
Wow, man. Yeah. You look good for 41.
Thanks, mate.
I did not. Yeah. So when I was reading your LinkedIn profile, I was like, this guy's done loads. Like,
yeah. Not quickly. Yeah. So like for me, I'm never gonna be a fighter. But I'm happy to spar, and sometimes you get hurt, you know. But you choose with something like that, you choose your own level of involvement.
And I'm guessing you're very passionate about the UFC.
Ish. Yeah, my best mate in the whole world absolutely loves UFC. I'm totally happy to watch it with him. But yeah, I actually, UFC is kind of...
You think he'll get banned?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. Right. No, I mean, those guys are making real money now. That's making such a change. But for me, like, UFC is only half Muay Thai and half Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stuff that really makes Muay Thai incredibly effective is removed from UFC. Because otherwise the jiu-jitsu stuff would be harder to do.
What's a fact about you that not many people know?
I once, as a kid, got run over by a kid on a BMX. So I'd just been to see Superman at the cinema, and I was tiny, like, I don't know, 6 or 7 or something like that. And I ran out of the car with my little mate towards my house and my driveway. And as I ran across the pavement, this kid totally mowed me down with a BMX, like proper silver mongoose, like mag wheels, all that kind of stuff. And basically it was the coolest thing I'd ever seen. I was like, wow, that actually beats Superman. So, you know, sitting there with tears coming out of my eyes, like scuffed up on that, I was like, I must have one of those.
Yeah.
I didn't ever get one of those.
Silver mongoose. God, that takes it back.
Yeah.
If you could meet anyone, who would you want to meet?
Philip K. Dick.
Who is?
He's a writer. He's responsible for, amongst other books, the book that turned into Blade Runner, and obviously Minority Report, and a lot of stuff like that. But he was very active in the 70s, primarily, and he wrote a lot. He wrote a lot of books, and I've got a lot of his books. But what he does is he kind of wraps up kind of like his ideas about the human condition in worlds that can kind of make sense to him at the time. So he uses sci-fi really just as a prop to make that happen. But he's just such an insightful guy about like spirituality and about like how we as human beings behave with each other that I would just love to meet the guy, just listen to him.
Is he based in London?
No, he was American. He's dead now.
Oh, okay. So, it's going to be a hard meet. But
yeah, I've totally missed my chance on
maybe
that one.
In the afterlife.
Exactly.
Do you have any projects on the go right now that we can check out? If so, where? And where are the best places for people to reach you?
So Fabric is the only thing that's going on right now. And I just want to talk a little bit about where that's going, because it's important to us. Like, we're trying to get some cool stuff happening with Fabric, and trying to get some automation in there so that we can start making more decisions about how creatives display their work, to take the load off you and actually to use the resources we have to make those decisions happen. So we would like to start trying to effectively gamify creating a portfolio, so to make it as easy as possible to encourage and to suggest the best route for different kinds of creatives to get what they want. That's a long-term goal for us, and it's something that I'm working on, trying to figure out how that actually happens with the resources that we've got, to make sure that creativity isn't something that's hard to get across. You know, for a creative, it's just like you kind of sign up, you put your work on there, and you're always kind of like brought back to the product and to get more out of it all the time, and to share it harder and faster. We're trying to work with Elo at the moment, who are a creative social network in the States, because I think we have the same values as companies with those guys. They're trying to really empower creatives and to get their work out.
So I've not heard of this platform. What do they do?
They were a social network when they first started, and they were very much against kind of adverts and very much pro-privacy. But over time, they've moved to a more creative kind of network.
They sold their soul.
No, they are still still totally like core values. They just, you know, the social network like at large wasn't something that really worked for them, but so they kind of brought it back to just creatives. And I hope, and I really want them to do really well in the next couple of years. And I kind of want to work with them on that one as well.
So final question. This is the one where you can provide the most value to my small listenership, if that's what you call it. If you could give the world one piece of meaningful advice to help people live a better and more meaningful life, what would it be?
I think just to be accountable for everything that you do and say. I think that if you take responsibility for what you do, you end up treating other people the way that you would like to be treated yourself, which I think is something that's somewhat missing. When we get all of our information from social media and we end up in an echo chamber of stuff that we only hear from our direct friends and people that actually have the same interests as us, it's like, you know, there is a bigger world out there and everyone has different opinions. But I think as long as you're accountable for everything you say and do, I think you're making the world a better place.
It's a lovely way to end it.
Thanks, mate.
I really appreciate it. Just want to say thank you so much for doing this, and I really appreciate just being kind of taken into the Fabric ecosystem, and look forward to seeing how it all takes off in the future.
Yeah, definitely, man. I think we'll be doing a lot more stuff together anyway.
Wicked. All right, we'll leave it there, guys. Thanks very much for tuning in. Have a great time wherever you are in the world, and bye for now. Hey folks, just wanted to say thank you for listening. If there's anything from the show that you wanted to delve into in more depth, you can do so over at the show notes, which you'll find at rickyrichards.com. While you're there, if you'd like to subscribe to the podcast, you can now do so via iTunes, Stitcher and SoundCloud. If anyone is feeling particularly generous, I appreciate every single review left on iTunes. It does me the world of favours and helps me to attract more notable guests to the show. Lastly, if you'd like episodes directly into your inbox, you can do so via the mailing list, which you will find on every page of my website, which I will repeat is rickyrichards.com. Thank you for listening. I appreciate every single one of you. Have a great day wherever you are in the world. Bye for now.